When a nation prepares to change.
I think we should be helping the opposition groups.
In a land of oil.
We'd also be giving them body armour that the British Army no longer needs.
Through non-military means. I authorize the armed forces of the United States to begin a limited military action in Libya.
When others make the decisions.
We will have saved lives, helped Libyans choose their own future.
Decisions that lead to death and destruction.
We would not put ground troops into Libya.
We do look to other nations to increase their ground strike capabilities in order to protect the civilian.
Decisions that lead to war.
As Libya is caught up in a devastating civil war, Britain seems unsure of how to proceed with this important trading partner. In the last decade, as far as Britain's been concerned, Libya has been a sponsor of terrorism, an important strategic ally, and now a country in need of regime change. On this week's Big Story, we ask, just how far is Britain willing to go to achieve its own aims in Libya, and what will this mean for the rest of the region?
Just 3 months ago, Gaddafi was seen as being a friend of the West. There was a lot of British business interests in Libya.
What is now worrying slightly is that we seem to be seeing mission creep in terms of the interpretation of the UN resolution.
The people themselves aren't, as it were, trained. It's not like a democracy in France. If President Sarkozy is defeated at next year's election here, maybe the socialists will take over or somebody else, but there'll be a democratic party. But these forces are being thrown together.
With events in Libya moving so fast, it's sometimes hard to remember just how checkered Britain's past relationship with the country has been. Given Libya's status as an international pariah and sponsor of terrorism, the relatively recent rehabilitation of Colonel Gaddafi came as a surprise to many. That Tony Blair was able to do business with a man supposedly responsible for the deaths of so many, including Britons on British soil, says much about the driving forces of British foreign policy. Yet since the UN declaration on the growing civil war, many here are concerned that an ostensibly humanitarian mission is acting as cover for regime change. Mr. Love, how would you assess Britain's role in Libya at the moment?
Well, obviously Britain is playing a very prominent role in the Libyan campaign and has taken leadership of this particular issue, and I was in favour, although needed to be persuaded on the UN resolution. What is now worrying slightly is that we seem to be seeing mission creep in terms of the interpretation of the UN resolution, and I am slightly worried that we may be going beyond our brief.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there is now active talk about regime change in Libya.
Mr. Walker, how do you assess Britain's role in Libya presently?
Well, I think it's a difficult role because it's sort of been thrust further into the front line by America than it really wanted to be. I mean, I think Mr. Cameron, the Prime Minister, was hoping, you know, it would be the triumvirate who signed the letter, who did everything equally. Obama, for America, Sarkozy for France and Britain. But as it is, President Obama got sort of not cold feet, but I mean he got a public opinion warning that America was not going to be the sort of number one player in this. And after a few days, if you remember, he withdrew slightly from leading the raids.
We've seen a very dramatic U-turn in Britain's position towards Libya. I mean, just 3 months ago, Gaddafi was seen as being a friend of the West. There was a lot of British business interests in Libya. That policy was really put in place by the previous British government, but nonetheless, it was continuing, you know, until basically February this year. So this has been a very dramatic and quite sudden shift in British policy.
Mm-hmm. Why do we think that is?
I think it's partly because there was a genuine outcry over the humanitarian problems in Libya. But at the same time, there have been humanitarian concerns about other countries in the Arab world. I think in the case of Libya, Gaddafi actually has very few friends internationally, and it was relatively easy to get a coalition of people to back the no-fly zone against him. In other places, that sort of international consensus has not really been forthcoming.
So despite the rapprochement with the UK, Gaddafi remains isolated on the international stage. Whilst UN action has sought to protect civilians from the worst of the fighting, many now feel that the most active participants in this conflict are going far beyond the remit of Resolution 1973.
Now, I've said before in this House that we must do everything to comply with both the Security Council resolutions. And as I told the House, the legal position is clear that the arms embargo applies to the whole territory of Libya. But at the same time, UNSCR 1973 allows all necessary measures to protect civilians and civilian-populated areas. And our view is this would not necessarily rule out the provision of assistance to those protecting civilians in circumstances. So as I've told the House before, we do not rule it out, but we have not taken the decision to do so.
The wave of protest across the Middle East have followed very different paths in different nations. The West's response to them has been equally varied. Questions are rightly being asked as to why Libya has become the target of extensive military and diplomatic interest when other authoritarian governments have not been subjected to such scrutiny.
The Prime Minister was very clear when the motion was debated in the House that what we were there was to protect civilians in a very difficult circumstance in Libya. Some of the comments that had been made by the Libyan leadership were of great concern, and people wanted to make sure that individual civilians were protected in those circumstances. But what we now seem to be seeing is that's been replaced. Now that that particular danger is over, except in the border area between the two forces, we seem to be moving the emphasis towards regime change. There's now active talk about Colonel Gaddafi having to go. And while we all have our own individual views about Colonel Gaddafi and his regime, in my view, that was never part of the resolution. And therefore, if they want to have so-called mission creep, they need to come back to the House of Commons for a further discussion on that particular issue.
Why are we involved? That wasn't our fight, as it were.
No, I think that's, you're speaking for a large part of the British electorate. They don't really want to be involved there. Britain hasn't got any, long-term interests in Libya, and it's got a lot of very bad history because the Lockerbie bombing, the arming of the IRA, the unsolved shooting of the policewoman Yvonne Fletcher from the Libyan embassy in London are all deep wounds that have not been solved. But I suppose if you wanted a three-letter answer to why we're involved, it must be oil. Because without oil, I don't think we would be involved, which is perhaps well illustrated by the fact we're not involved in Bahrain.
There is so much happening about this Arab Spring, and everybody, brighter minds than mine, have been trying to think about what's the next step, what goes on next. Do you think Britain's role in these new governments, in these new regimes, will change? How do we do business with these new governments now?
Well, I mean, we've been very heartened by what has happened in both Tunisia and in Egypt. Indeed, peaceful change is what we would much prefer to see in all of these countries. And it looks likely, and of course we keep our fingers crossed, that that will happen both in Egypt and Tunisia, and they should be the example for other countries of the Middle East.
How will the uprisings change the way Britain does business in that region? How do we know what angle to go in now? Do we go softly, softly, or do we say, hey guys, we're back in business, let's continue as we were?
I think Britain will be trying to engage with the new political players. One of the dilemmas it faces is how it goes about dealing with some of the Islamist movements that are likely to be increasingly important, especially in Egypt. My understanding from my research in Egypt is that there is an appetite on behalf of some of the newer political actors in Egypt to keep relations with the West, to continue engaging with the West, but they want to do it on slightly different terms. They want to do it on more of an equal footing and of more respect from the West.
And what of the future in the region for British investments particularly?
I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities. I think the reconstruction, there'll be a lot of opportunities there. Remember, we've already had a lot of opportunities in that region, but when you have the reconstruction, that's going to be really big for engineering, infrastructure type firms. New regimes are going to look to even more greatly expand the oil. That'll be very popular as well. And I can see it growing, whichever way the result goes.
Will these uprisings change Britain's foreign policy towards the region? Is this a point where we change our foreign policy approach, or it's a bump in the road?
Oh, I think it's more than a bump in the road. There are 22 member states of the Arab League, and there's no doubt at all that whatever happens in one, two, is it three, four, five, is going to go on. I mean, the one thing you can safely predict is this will not end soon, and it's more than a bump in the road. When you say change foreign policy, I mean, when you're being philosophical, British foreign policy is dictated by British interests. There was an effort by the late Robin Cook to introduce what was called an ethical foreign policy. Well, that, you know, turned out to be a load of hot air, because foreign policies on the whole aren't ethical. They're to help the country that's making the policy. So Britain will look to its interests, and I don't think we can predict what they will be, but they are almost certain to be different in different countries. Look, in Bahrain, there are the headquarters of the US Fifth Fleet, which controls the whole of the Middle East region. So America's policy towards the Bahraini ruling despot king is quite different than, say, towards Libya, where there are no troops or air bases or any such things. And Britain is the same. We have strong military ties with certain Gulf countries, and obviously we're going to be very wary about seeing their leaders necessarily overthrown. A lot of them, of course, who went to Sandhurst, our Army Officers College, and were trained there.
Whilst an ethical foreign policy, such as the one that cost Robin Cook his job, may be the desire of many, Libya's natural resources and trade potential appear to have been the major driving force behind the flurry of activity. Perhaps some lessons have been learned from the American arming of the Mujahideen during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. One of the major problems facing Britain and her allies in Libya is that we simply don't have an understanding of who the rebels are and what they might become in the future.
We talk about the new government's post-uprisings. How will Britain negotiate that very delicate balance? You want to be in with the new guys, but at the same time, history is very recent about your support of the old guard.
Yeah, well, I think, every morning, Mr. Cameron and his allies probably should have a little think back fairly recently to Afghanistan, where they armed the rebellious Taliban who were fighting against the communist-controlled government in Kabul, and gave them lots of rocket launchers and heavy weapons, and now they find them turned against themselves. The Taliban is, you know, the enemy of Britain, and so they've got to be very, very selective and careful of how they deal with these forces. Also, don't forget, these forces are coming up in countries that by definition have no real true political culture. They've all been run by despotic presidents or by unelected kings and emirs. So the people themselves aren't, as it were, trained. It's not like a democracy in France. If President Sarkozy is defeated at next year's election here, maybe the socialists will take over or somebody else, but there'll be a democratic party. But these forces are being thrown together. You hear of, you know, a variety of ex-ministers of the old guard, taxi drivers from London, dentists, you know, everybody is joining in, but nobody knows how they'll function if they were actually in government. I mean, I think what we've also got to do is remember what's happened in Egypt, where a lot of people feel that the revolution, or call it what you will, has been hijacked by the army.
I don't think I want to get into what the rights and wrongs of whether or not Colonel Gaddafi is the appropriate person to lead Libya into the future. I think that everyone, as I say, has their own view about that. I think the issue is, we said that we would follow the UN resolution. We've done that in protecting innocent civilians. I'm satisfied that that part of the mandate has been achieved, or mostly achieved. It wasn't part of the mandate, as I understood it. And indeed, the Prime Minister himself was very clear, even when President Obama said that his mission was to replace Colonel Gaddafi, Prime Minister said that that wasn't part of the UN resolution, it wasn't part of what he was about, and he was taking a leadership role in completing the UN resolution as it stood, and that he would come back to the House of Commons, or he would go back to the United Nations if they wanted to extend the remit of the resolution because of changed circumstances. I think he now needs to do that.
Of course, there is no question that Libya and the world would be better off with Gaddafi out of power. I, along with many other world leaders, have embraced that goal and will actively pursue it through non-military means. But broadening our military mission to include regime change would be a mistake. Thanks to the extraordinary sacrifices of our troops and the determination of our diplomats, we are hopeful about Iraq's future. But regime change there took 8 years, thousands of American and Iraqi lives, and nearly $1 trillion. That is not something we can afford to repeat in Libya.
With trade as a central pillar of the response to the growing civil war in the country, the future of Anglo-Libyan relations appear uncertain. How will the rebels, now in control of much of the country's oil infrastructure, deal with nations that have until now been so close to a man who oppressed them and refused them any voice?
Despite the sanctions that are supposed to be in place, the Libyan Investment Authority is still completing the building of a £30 million hotel in London. The sanctions aren't working, are they?
Well, it's not clear at the moment. It's supposed to be frozen, yet they're still working on particular things. So it's not actually clear whether we have succeeded in freezing or freezing these assets. However, the likes of Pearson, for example, they're struggling with those stakes because they've had to freeze it. They're not paying dividends to the Libyan Investment Authority. Like I say, it's just not clear at the moment exactly what will happen with that.
But it seems here that you're putting profit before people.
Well, it's difficult because you've got an opportunity out there. We've had that opportunity for several years. You turn it down, you let other countries get that business opportunity. But there is certainly an argument over the last 6 or 7 years, should we have been doing work with Gaddafi? It's been a repressive regime. It's not a surprise to us that it is. I think in terms of the future, it's still important to develop these regions, and we can genuinely help with that as well as make money at the same time.
So does it all come down to pounds and pence?
I think that's a lot of it. We're a trading nation. We've always been a free market economy. We see an opportunity. We're trying to develop it. But there isn't... Do we have an ethical foreign policy? We don't really. So, yes, a lot of it does come down to dollars and cents.
This is the difficulty, and this is again why I'm worried about the talk about introducing arms to the rebels. Whatever happens, we need to avoid the sort of the West has intervened and taken part in this revolution, for whether Gaddafi stays or not. If he leaves, we want the people in Libya to have legitimacy for their new system.
The key for the West, particularly the British and French governments, is to try and ensure that they side with whomever may prevail from this bloody and potentially long-lasting conflict. Libya possesses significant oil reserves, and this could play an important role in a region undergoing its biggest transformation in a generation. Perhaps there's too much cynicism in this analysis, but the last decade of a shoot-first foreign policy, it's difficult not to imagine ulterior motives.
Are the uprisings a business opportunity for British companies?
I'm sure British companies are always seeing business opportunities, but it was rather embarrassingly displayed when Prime Minister Cameron became, I believe, the first Western leader to visit one of the newly revolted countries, i.e. Egypt, and took with him a plane load of arms manufacturers as well as journalists and others. And this had a sort of left a nasty taste, because of course all countries try and profit business-wise from what's happening in other countries. The French are notoriously good for that and have sold nuclear know-how to many parts of the Gulf states in recent years. But Britain will, of course, try to do that. Every country sort of fights for its business interest, but it's rather unpleasant when such naked capitalism is exposed. I think they'd like to do it rather more discreetly. Maybe send out our famous ambassador, Prince Andrew, to have some meetings with the rebels.
I think the uncertainty over what will happen in Libya is creating quite a lot of anxiety. We saw the uprisings in Tunisia and in Egypt pass off relatively peacefully. They inspired a lot of other opposition groups. But the violence in Libya, I think, is worrying many and making people think that uprisings could lead to more serious conflict.
With Libya in danger of moving into an unpredictable and drawn-out stalemate, those involved nations appear to be struggling for ideas. With the Afghan and Iraq conflicts fresh in the minds of many, and budget stretch, Western nations appear less certain than ever as what their role in the world actually is. As the world waits, the Libyan people seem likely to bear the brunt of a continued Western taste for free market capitalism and military intervention.
You mentioned that what happens in Libya will be very, very significant to how we're seen in the rest of North Africa and the Middle East. You think people can trust us after sliding along our objectives a little bit there in Libya?
I mean, I hope that if David Cameron is intent on extending the remit, I hope he will do the right thing and bring it back to the House of Commons, because I think you will find there are many voices on all sides who will be concerned about that, and that will be a signal to the Middle East that whilst we stand by our humanitarian principles that underlie that United Nations resolution, in a sense we have learned some of the lessons of our previous involvements in the Middle East, which weren't successful.
What happens if Gaddafi sticks to it and stays in Tripoli?
There's some very red faces at the next NATO summit and a lot of hot air in the West, but there's nothing really that people can do. I don't think they're going to, my personal inclination is they're not going to step up the battle against him to the extent of sending in troops, because you wouldn't have to send in 10 or 20 troops, you'd have to set in tens of thousands of troops. It's a huge country, Libya, geographically spread over thousands of miles of desert. So I think people will grit their teeth, and maybe eventually, I don't like to be a party pooper, but they may have to try and force the rebels to agree to some sort of talks in which Gaddafi remains in power, which is the sticking point at the moment. The rebels say no talks until Gaddafi and his family have gone, and Gaddafi and his family won't go.